Thanks. So, today, Guillaume and I will be talking about some of our ongoing efforts to develop asymptotically reduced models of strongly stratified shear flows. And I should say before I get started that this is work we've been pursuing with Colm Caulfield and Damped, Keith Julian at UC Boulder. He was here for the conference the week before. And Cesar Roca, who just completed his PhD like a couple of weeks ago with Bill Young down at Scripps Institute of Oceanography. This seemed like an opportune time to talk about this work, partly because Guillaume is taking off in a day or two and we're all going home in a week, but also because we've had a number of talks on stratified turbulence, starting back with Igor early in the program, and yesterday Georgios talked about stratified turbulence as well. But really, my focus today will not so much be on the science of stratified turbulence as on developing a methodology for studying this phenomenon and perhaps other geophysical phenomena. And so in this way as well, I think it's an opportune time to talk about this work because it provides a nice illustration of some of the asymptotic techniques that I gave a series of tutorials on early in the program. At the same time, it turns out that the reduced model we derive has a quasi-linear structure, as I'll emphasize. So given that Brad and Joe gave a nice talk the other day on QL models and CE2, I think this provides some nice connections. And again, the main message here is for certain problems and certain asymptotic limits, QL can be at least formally justified. Furthermore, I think the asymptotic approach has some advantages in that we'll demonstrate that an extension of QL, basically, that is very much motivated by the asymptotics, and in fact led us to introduce the creatively named generalized quasi-linear approach, GQL instead of QL. I'll say a few words about that in just a moment. Finally, Guillaume will be talking in the second half of this hour, I guess, about how we might increase the efficiency of QL simulations, particularly when they're formally justifiable in an asymptotic limit and you have temporal scale separation. How can you really exploit that computationally? And in fact, that requires the derivation of a rather new type of amplitude equation, for those that know the lingo. So a bit of new asymptotics that at least I haven't seen elsewhere. Okay, so this is just in some ways because Brad did not discuss this a couple of days ago. There's a sort of, maybe with hindsight, obvious extension of QL, but I think a very important one that I mentioned is called, we call GQL, generalized quasi-linear formulation, in which instead of decomposing into fluctuations and a strict mean, say a strict zonal or streamwise mean, we generalize that slightly by using, say, for example, a spectral filter where we decompose into low and high modes. Okay, so we think of the low modes as the mean-like field or slowly varying mean, and the high modes as the fluctuations. And again, the high modes would satisfy equations that are linear with respect to the low modes. So there, that is to say, there are no high mode fluctuations in the evolution of the high modes themselves. It's a little more involved in that because this decomposition, when lambda is some finite number, is not a Reynolds decomposition. So you have to be a little bit careful in how you do the dissection. Okay, but you can truncate in an energy conserving way.
That a Reynolds decomposition is Fourier. It's the averaging operator is a projection operator.
When you have the product of two low fields.
Yep, it doesn't.
Outside of the range of the filter. So you have two long wavelength modes multiplied together gives you a higher wavelength mode that is no longer in the filter. So it breaks the.
So you could have a two mode, if lambda is three and two interact, they could make four. That interaction is.
Yeah, but I'm still trying to think about the implication for Reynolds averaging.
Yeah, you're averaging in time. Right.
No.
No, I mean, the Reynolds average is in time.
I think you can take a slightly more general interpretation of Reynolds averaging.
If you just do Reynolds averaging, you're averaging in time, then what
you're saying. I certainly agree with what Brad said in explanation. A Fourier cutoff is a projection operator. Reynolds averaging is basically a result of projection arbitrary. So depending on where you're going, I'm not quite sure why you need to make that.
Maybe I shouldn't make that qualification. And in any case, it is what it is. It is what it is, right? So what we found, I mean, what's nice about doing this, however, and again, you know, this is obvious, okay? The way in which you remove the triads in an energy-conserving way, which Brad and Steve Tobias sorted out, that takes some thought, and then coding, you know, takes effort, of course. But the nice thing about doing this is that we can sort of interpolate or have a homotopy between quasi-linear formulations on the one extreme and DNS on the other simply by varying the cutoff, right? So we can, when this cutoff is zero, this is just the mean mode and these are the fluctuations and this is QL. Whereas when lambda, the cutoff goes to infinity, you know, all the modes are quote unquote low modes and the low modes satisfy fully nonlinear equations. So that in that limit, you recover DNS. So you have a way of switching in between. What we found in at least a series of examples is sort of a disproportionate improvement in the accuracy of GQL over QL when we retain a rather modest number, 0 to 10, you know, 1 to 10 low modes. Now we have no proofs of anything. You know, we could cherry pick examples. I don't think we've tried to do that. But
and you haven't defined GQL yet.
Well.
You mean QL?
No, sorry.
What does your accuracy statement refer to? Next to the bottom line.
Accuracy relative to DNS, or compared to QL, if you like.
Ah, so GQL simply means finite lambda.
That's right.
Okay, sorry, gotcha.
Okay, yes?
So, but the accuracy statement must depend on the problem.
I admit it. We have no proofs of anything. It depends on the problem, on the parameter regime, etc. But it's a little surprising that in some of the problems that we've attempted, you get significant improvements for a modest value of the cutoff.
Right. So this 5 is like QG-like sort of system?
5 was
for barotropic. For algebraic problems that Joe talked about, right? A couple days ago, three-dimensional boundary layer problems. We choose lambda equals 5. It looks very close to DNS.
5 relative to what? Is that the boundary layer thickness or?
No.
Sorry, it's a mode.
Wave number. So you're keeping 256 waves in each direction, and here we're retaining, we're fully treating nonlinearly in the first lowest 5. So right. A very small subsector.
But manifestly, I guess. Problems that have some sort of near zone of flow, for example, or something like that, right? It's not fully turbulent.
Right. There's some coherent structures.
It's certainly not isotropic turbulence. Isotropic. I mean, depends on your definition of turbulence, but I like turbulence that has structure, personally.
This approach is the same manifesto as large eddy simulation. It's just you're using QL as your subject scale model.
Exactly. Yeah.
Right, and just the final comment on this is that I would refer to QL if the corresponding simulations is instantaneous simulations, whereas one could also do statistical simulations by starting with QL and formulating closed equations for the first and second cumulants, as Brad described, CE2. So we can also do the same with this.
I have one. Sort of irritating question, sorry. On the previous discussion of whether or not this is a Reynolds average, that's not that important, but when you do GQL, say you take the first 5 modes,
yes.
Now you have all the nonlinear products among those.
Yep.
Some of those project outside of
that's right.
Modes,
absolutely.
And you're throwing that away.
Yep.
But you're not throwing out the ones that come back into the 5 that you've got. That's what you mean by full nonlinearity. It's actually
a pseudo-spectral
truncation.
Yeah. That's right.
It's not even quite a pseudo-spectral truncation. It's a spectral truncation.
That's right.
With the one-way transfer into the QL modes.
No, there's a closure.
I mean, I think I agree with everything you said, but let me just repeat that if you had 2 low modes and they interacted and generated a mode that was beyond the cutoff, we chuck that right? That's, but if the two low modes interact, two and negative one make one or something, we keep that. That's a nonlinear interaction that is retained.
Right. So okay. From the perspective of the modes that are now in QL form,
yep.
Their mean that they're seeing is the combination of all of the low modes.
That's right. Like a slowly varying mean.
Not any low mode variability that ends up as a mean for the high modes. That's kind of, I'm trying to figure out which interactions you're dropping.
I should have written out another set of three
yeah.
that we omit. And you do this to one justification is to make sure that you have an energy conserving truncation. Okay, I mean, you could just say a priori, I want my model to be energy conserving, the nonlinear interactions. So you're then forced to omit, there's another set of three diagrams that I haven't drawn.
Right.
Okay.
But and you're energy conserving overall, or you're energy conserving only within the mean modes? That's what I'm trying to get at.
Overall.
Overall.
The whole system.
But you do have an energy transfer out of the mean modes into the other. Yeah.
And, okay. And in fact, there is now the possibility of a cascade.
Right.
Once lambda is different than zero, we do a repeated cascade from, say, high modes down to low modes.
So this is different in detail than LES.
Very much so.
For that reason.
Yeah.
It's not different in
yeah. going. At some high level philosophically.
A lot of LES will claim that they are energy conserving.
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm going to charge ahead because that's actually not my talk, and Guillaume will never have a chance. But it just seems since we had this discussion on QL the other day, and given that, I mean, GQL kind of grew out of discussions Brad and I had bringing together asymptotic approaches with QL, and so it just seemed like. So I just ask you to, you know, kind of put that in the back of your mind, and we'll return to that later. Right. So just a few words about, you know, stratified turbulence. I'm interested in the really strongly stratified regime. Okay. And in the very strongly stratified regime, one thing that seems to be robust is the emergence of layering. And so, you know, this is an experiment from Steve Thorpe back in the 70s where I believe he had, it's tilted tank and he had two miscible fluids. So I think it was fresh water and salt water. Tilts the tank, puts it back down, gets nice Kelvin-Helmholtz billows, but the fluids are miscible and they mix. And you get, you know, the point is to start here. You have some kind of homogeneous fluid now with all this mix that's mixed. But as the turbulence decays, you see the layers emerge. So this is a spin-down experiment in 3D, of course. It was a physical experiment. This is a spin-down of the 2D Boussinesq equations, no Coriolis effects by Cesar Rocha. And just, again, as a toy model and kind of illustrate the emergence of this layering, this is the vorticity field coming out the page. And after 30 buoyancy periods of decay, this is the kind of thing you see in this field. So again, highly anisotropic structures, layers, with horizontal scales, capital L, that are small compared to their vertical scales, H. We'll talk more about those in a minute. At the same time, if you look carefully, you certainly see small scale overturns, maybe Kelvin-Helmholtz instabilities, things like that, that coexist with these anisotropic layers. Okay, stratified turbulence exists as a regime unto itself when the stratification is really strong, when it's sufficiently strong that the so-called horizontal Froude number.
You're trying to race ahead, but.
Sorry.
In these experiments.
Yep.
Everyone that has ever been done gets to the late time period with strong viscous control. So they're basically diffusive spin downs in the late stages.
We can argue about that. I think there, in recent years, are spin-down simulations in which there is a period of time in which it's not viscously controlled. Bartel, in fact, by Steve Tobias and Peter Bartello, for example. I myself would prefer a statistically steady regime, so I'm quite happy that there'd be some forcing, but then there are also lots of debates about if you're doing simulation, what should the forcing be, and how does mixing depend on forcing, etc. But good, fair enough. Right, so still charging ahead. Stratified turbulence exists as a regime unto itself when the stratification is sufficiently strong that the horizontal Froude number, which is defined here, is very small, and one has a separation in scales between, say, the QG regime, in which rotation is certainly strong and constraining, And the so-called Osmodov scale, which is the smallest scale below, the smallest scale below which the effects of buoyancy are not any more dynamically active. So we could have 3D Kolmogorov turbulence out here, rotating turbulence out there. And if the fruit is sufficiently small and the Reynolds number sufficiently large, that the dynamics in this regime, you know, we could have instabilities and turbulence in some sense, then we have stratified turbulence. So I should define some of these letters. So N, of course, is the buoyancy frequency. U here and throughout will be a typical horizontal velocity of the layer-like flow, okay? Of pancakes, if you have pancakes in your 3D dynamics. L would be an associated horizontal scale of the layers, right? H is the vertical scale. And so then some simple scaling arguments show that the ratio between L and L naught, the Osmodov scale, goes like fruit to the negative 3/2. Right. So this is now becoming an old diagram, and I hope that some folks that do DNS might be happy to update it. But in 2007, Brett Howard L. published a paper in JFM in which they included this regime diagram. Okay. And so on this, it's log-log plot, Reynolds number, bare Reynolds number, versus the inverse of the horizontal Froude number. So stratification is increasing this way. And then they map out these different regimes, and they've shaded in gray here what they would categorize as the strongly stratified turbulence regime, probably put a couple dots down for the ocean and the atmosphere. I mean, two points to be made. One is that the ocean and atmosphere, stratified turbulence as it is believed to occur in the ocean and atmosphere is characterized by, you know, extreme parameter values, right? Froude numbers that are 10 to the negative 2, maybe smaller, and Reynolds numbers that are 10 to the 8th or bigger. So extreme parameter regimes that were, the second point is that at least in 2007, and again, I wish this diagram could be updated, this was way outside the reach of DNS, basically, in laboratory experiments.
Can I make
yes,
a comment
please,
about
please
this,
do.
This diagram?
Yep.
Okay, so it matters how you define stuff.
Of course.
And I think some of the definitions of the numbers that are on this diagram are a little bit wrong. And there's like this very high Reynolds numbers there. That it really matters how you define Reynolds number and how things are, because some of the stuff that are going to these Reynolds numbers, they are not really fluctuations. They are kind of like coherent horizontal motions. That
yeah, absolutely.
Turbulence.
Right.
And so this is not, I mean, I have some complaints and disagreements about what is going on here, but this is the only thing I want to say, that it matters how you define these things. And for different simulations and papers, you have to be careful of how you compare this stuff.
Fair enough. Okay, so there are a number of basic questions. What sets the vertical scale, not just of the layers, but you know there are other emergent scales, both smaller than the layer thickness, and I think in the simulations you see hints of modulation in the vertical on scales much larger than the layer thickness. So what sets those scales? We're very interested in mixing properties. There are sort of raging debates in the community over what is the mixing efficiency in the stratified turbulence regime. And then this is just another comment from the Bartel and Tobias paper on the challenge of doing DNS. Okay, so again, my approach is not DNS, and it's not LES, but it's rather an asymptotic one. And so the place to start is a discussion of the scaling of the governing equations, okay? So here I've written out the non-rotating Boussinesq equations, and they've been scaled anisotropically. So perpendicular, if you see, it refers to the horizontal plane perpendicular to gravity. So X and Y have been scaled with this pancake scale, if you like, horizontal scale, capital L, whereas the vertical coordinate Z has been non-dimensionalized by H, the thickness of these layers. Time is scaled by the eddy to turnover time, say, of one of these pancakes. The horizontal velocity, as I mentioned, is scaled by capital U. The vertical velocity has got some funny scaling at the outset that comes from balancing these two terms in the buoyancy equation, but it will collapse to something simple soon enough. The pressure and then the buoyancy, this comes from a hydrostatic type balance. Okay, so we see three dimensionless parameters. So we've already met the horizontal Froude number. We have the Reynolds number, UL on nu. And then we also have an aspect ratio because of the anisotropic scaling, so H over L. So I call that alpha. Okay. So now when thinking about taking the limit, we have to be careful about what's held fixed and what, you know, as we take that limit. And so it had been proposed early on that strongly stratified turbulence, of course, corresponds to horizontal Froude being very small. So let's just, you know, set horizontal Froude to zero and see what we get. And if you do that sort of naively, you get hydrostatics in the vertical, and you lose all these vertical advection terms. And in fact, in incompressibility, you just get a 2D divergence-free field. So you get basically a limit set of equations that describes roughly 2D turbulence, if you will, with very weak coupling in the vertical. And then you get the concomitant consequences, like inverse cascades of energy, et cetera. But there's another possibility that certainly has gained traction since the time of this work, which is, of course, a long time ago. And that is that as the Froude number goes to zero, as the stratification is increased, say, that vertical scale H adjusts dynamically to keep pace. So if the ratio Froude on alpha, shown in red here, remains order one as Froude goes to zero, then we can ask what limit equations do we get. We still get hydrostatics in the vertical. But now, in the horizontal, we retain vertical advection. We retain vertical advection in the buoyancy equation. And we retain three-dimensional incompressibility. In fact, what we obtain are really nothing other than the so-called hydrostatic primitive equations. Okay. Right. So that limit set clearly has much stronger three-dimensionality than the layer-wise 2D flow. Right. So as I say, there's been mounting evidence since, you know, the 80s that this latter interpretation is appropriate for strongly stratified shear turbulence. And so the idea is that the vertical length scale adjusts so that that ratio alpha is of order Froude. Basically, what that means when you untangle it is that H is the so-called buoyancy scale. So H is U on N. And that means alpha is of order Froude. And then, as an aside, our vertical velocity is just what you expect to retain, right, incompressibility, 3D incompressibility. It's smaller than U by this aspect ratio parameter alpha. OK, so we'll define for our purposes the stratified turbulence regime as Froude going to zero with alpha order Froude and the so-called buoyancy Reynolds number sufficiently large. Okay, so the buoyancy Reynolds number, for my purposes, is the bare Reynolds number times Froude squared. And one can see where that shows up. It's the diffusion coefficient, or inverse of it, in the hydrostatic primitive equations with this anisotropic scaling. Right. So alpha is the aspect ratio. Alpha is of order Froude as part of the limit we're thinking about. So this is Froude squared times Reynolds. This term would dominate that one because this is small. And so it's that coefficient that we're saying has to be sufficiently large as Froude goes to zero, to still have some kind of stratified turbulence. And so this is, you know, a number. And that was from the paper of Bartello and Tobias. But, you know, certainly in the atmosphere and the oceans, one expects this, you know, probably 1,000 or 10,000.
To rephrase my previous remark, until the early 2000s, none of the results, numerical or laboratory, had large buoyancy Reynolds numbers.
That's right. That's exactly, yeah. Exactly. Okay. So, in the analysis I'm about to describe, this is the limit, the distinguished limit that we're considering. So this buoyancy Reynolds number will be a parameter, a reduced Reynolds number, that shows up in the reduced equations. You know, I've done the analysis assuming it's order one in the sense that asymptotically it's fixed as Froude goes to zero. I'm going to then take the liberty in my reduced equation, since it's a coefficient, to turn it up. Okay, but one could question whether from the outset you should try to treat this as a large parameter, and we're thinking a little bit about that as well. Okay, this image is from a three-dimensional simulation of the Boussinesq equations, non-rotating, from Michael Waite in 2014, and it shows a slice of the vorticity perpendicular to the page. Okay, and this is, to be fair, at a modest buoyancy Reynolds number of 6, or I can't remember what the number was actually. It was probably not even 10. But nevertheless, but the Froude number, I think, was on the order of 10 to the negative 2. And again, these are challenging simulations. My point in including this kind of image is to show something of the phenomenology that one sees in stratified turbulence to the extent it can be simulated with DNS. I mean, and to highlight, again, these anisotropic features with small-scale overturns that at least superficially look like Kelvin-Helmholtz instabilities or something else. So the idea is that we have dynamics on two rather disparate scales.
Just to delay you again.
Yes, please.
Because this is a subject that I've had substantial involvement in. That picture qualitatively will persist to arbitrarily large points.
I'm glad to hear that.
The original fallacy with Lilly's argument was presented by Lilly. Mm-hmm. And he did it with hands, and you didn't use your hands quite right.
Okay, show me.
This is flow at one level, this is flow at another level, arbitrarily close together.
Yeah.
In each level, it is two-dimensional turbulence by Lilly's asymptotic argument. And if they start correlated, they will stay correlated. But because this is a system of sensitive dependence, it will become decorrelated, and the vertical scale will become arbitrarily small, and so you will no longer have, you'll arrive at vertical scales that are sufficiently small that the vertical Froude number is order one.
That's right.
As in the Schoma picture, and you get these local overtures.
Thank you. That was perfect.
It was at least historical.
No, I think it was instructive as well. Right. Okay. So here's where we get into the methodology, which is really what I was hoping to present. So we've identified this distinguished limit, and now the idea is we're going to have two sets of scales, okay? So we'll have one vertical coordinate that is common to what will be defined as...
One more remark. It's a statement that this distinguished limit is not self-consistent.
What is a statement?
You will retain this large buoyancy Reynolds limit as the flow evolves. Then if a flow starts consistent with this limit, it will evolve to being inconsistent.
If it's unforced.
Either way, you will develop small vertical scales, small enough vertical scales, such that you get overturns and or vertical diffusion.
I think, so overturns is exactly what we'd like to capture with the model that I'm presenting. So the idea is that we have one vertical scale that's been non-dimensionalized by H. It's going to be a PDE. We can develop smaller scale features in it that we will resolve as a function of R, the rescaled Reynolds number. But in the horizontal and in time, we have multiple scales. So we have this large horizontal scale that I was calling capital L, and then we have a much smaller horizontal scale that is, in first instance, commensurate with the vertical scale to allow for isotropic overturns, for example. Okay. So we have two x coordinates, the fast one being, or short one being chi, and the original one being just x. And then we, associated with that, we have two time scales. We have the original time scale where this was the eddy turnover time of the pancakes. That was capital L over capital U. But we also have a time scale associated with these fast motions or waves that basically amounts to being the buoyancy time scale. Okay? So we have two times and two horizontal coordinates, or two sets of horizontal coordinates, but one vertical scale Z, or one, I shouldn't say one vertical scale, I should say one vertical coordinate Z, at least at the moment. And we then, in this game of multiple scale asymptotics, you suspend reality for a minute and pretend that you can have two x's and two times and that they are independently variable. right? That's what you do. And then we immediately decompose into a fast horizontal fast time average, that's denoted with the over bar, plus a fluctuation, which by construction has zero fast average. So the idea is that equations for these overbarred fields would capture the dynamics of the layers of the pancakes, if you will, eddies, horizontal eddies, whereas the fluctuating fields would capture the overturns or shear instabilities, etc. That's the name of the game. Okay. So having identified these scales, the next thing we have to do to proceed is to propose an appropriate asymptotic expansion of the various fields. Okay. So this is the key thing. The horizontal velocity, buoyancy, and pressure, I'll argue, have been scaled correctly using the large scales, that capital U, for example. So their expansion started order one. On the other hand, in stratified turbulence, it transpires that the vertical velocity is actually bigger on small scales than it is on the large scales. I mean, you've got these long, thin layers. By incompressibility, you have relatively weak vertical velocities. But when you have an isotropic overturn, who knows, potentially you could have a stronger vertical velocity. Okay. So the question then is how much bigger? Okay. So I would say the key prescription is that this W, which has already been rescaled by, remember, the aspect ratio. So that capital W is a vertical velocity normalized not by U, but by aspect ratio times U. Okay. So we need the expansion. You know, we expect that there'll be bigger vertical velocities. The question is how much bigger? Okay. And so I start with epsilon to the -1, and the question is, you know, why? Okay. And here are three reasons. Okay. One reason is you look at what are called dominant balances of terms. In particular, you look for a feedback associated with Reynolds stress divergence from the fluctuations driving the tendency of the mean fields. You want that to show up at the right order. So this pops out when you do that. The rescaling also ensures that the fine scale dynamics would be isotropic, which is nice. But, you know, for some people, maybe the most compelling reasoning would be that in Mafioli and Davidson simulations, they do some scaling analysis of their DNS, and they argue or show that the mean square vertical velocity goes like Froude times U squared and peaks at small scales. Okay, so Froude times, let's think about this. If we just had the large scale velocity, which remember is already a factor of Froude smaller than U, then W squared would be like Froude squared times U squared. On the other hand, it's possible that W is just massive and on the small scales, and W is of order the large scale horizontal velocity. But instead, what they find is that it's in between. So if you take the square root, this is square root Froude, and that is my expansion parameter, epsilon. Okay. If you buy this, you know, this is all what you dial in. The choice of scale, multiple scales, and the expansion. If you buy this, and then you stuff that into the governing equations, you will deduce that the fluctuating horizontal velocity, buoyancy, and pressure arise at order epsilon, meaning these guys really just have bars over them. And so that ends up being a key simplification. Is it really 2 o'clock? Oh, but we started at 1:30. Shoot, I thought we started at 1. Okay, so I will, despite the number of slides that are left, there's not too much more to say. This is the system we develop, okay? So skipping the details, let's not give away all of the story. So these are the equations for the leading order mean fields, okay? And if you suppress the fluctuation terms, these Reynolds stress divergence or eddy fluxes in blue, these are just the hydrostatic primitive equations, okay, which is what the Biot-Chaumont scaling, for example, would give. Okay. But the hydrostatic primitive equations cannot capture small-scale shear instabilities. They're ill-posed, in fact. And these Reynolds stress terms or eddy flux divergence terms self-consistently arise with our scalings. And so then to close the problem, we need to write down the equations for these leading-order fluctuation fields. And those are shown here. Okay, so this is a bit to digest. But I've highlighted in blue down here the mean fields, where there are occurrences of the mean fields. Okay, so the idea is that the fluctuations are advected by the horizontal sweeping velocity of the mean, the large-scale eddies, and the fluctuations feed off of vertical divergences of the mean fields, the shear, the buoyancy, or could be stabilized by them, depending. right? One thing that's conspicuous, so I'm being fully honest here, right? Froude is supposed to be asymptotically small, so these terms really should not be there. So we could think of the fluctuations essentially as being in viscid, which also seems sort of plausible. We keep them in our numerics as a cheap regularization, but this is a whole other discussion on what one should really do here. The key point is that if you look at these equations, you do not see fluctuation-fluctuation products here. They only show up where they feed back on the mean. So this is exactly a system that has that quasi-linear structure. And I would say in this case, it's arrived not by fiat, not in an ad hoc way, but at least formally justifiable in a physically relevant distinguished limit. This QL-type structure emerges. And I, go ahead. Yes. This is where you're supposed to object.
The previous remark can be expressed in this language, that if you take the top equation
yes.
and throw out the blue terms,
yep.
they will develop their own small scales. They will develop their own cascade to dissipation.
Right.
They will become inconsistent. The solutions will become inconsistent with the scaling assumptions.
That's right.
So your hope here is either that you run this system only a very short time, or that somehow those blue
do their job.
QL interaction terms suppress the cascade in the large scale equations and accomplish the dissipation, which is a big challenge.
Which is a big ask.
For a couple of little terms. But go ahead.
Yeah.
But I just wanted to clarify that,
your previous remark.
Previous remark in your language.
Okay. That's appreciated. I would add that at a minimum, you could say, right, this model is going to highlight the non-local interactions.
If it were to stay scale separate.
That's right.
Then it would be self-consistent.
That's right.
But what the solutions have shown is that you develop a continuum in between the simulations.
And Greg, you said also in passing that the hydrostatic primitive equations were ill-posed?
Yes. I don't think people talk about this, but they are.
Because only mathematicians say it because we solve them all the time.
I thought they weren't in the...
I'm certainly not a mathematician.
I thought they weren't when they're imperfect. I thought that was what TT showed.
What's that?
It was that they actually are well posed as long as you have a viscosity.
I think all you have to do is put an inflectional shear profile into the hydrostatic primitive equations and you'll be in trouble.
I thought he showed that that wasn't a problem.
He would be the person to prove it. I mean, I certainly...
I thought that was the whole point of that paper, okay. The primitive equations paper.
Okay.
Excuse me, who was the author you just
did? Andrew Stevie. He has a paper on the hydrostatic primitive equations in the when you have a viscous structure.
Such a gentle definition of well posed. I mean, but yeah, with viscosity, they're solved all the time.
Right. And so that's his point, is that if you have the viscosity, the whole system stays well-behaved. You can't break it.
Okay.
So because you have the viscosity in that, I don't think they're ill-posed.
No.
They're not
accurate. You did not have the viscosity.
No, but I mean...
You did.
I do have the viscosity. I have viscosity in large. The vertical derivative. It comes in properly. Yeah. But that doesn't save you. I mean,
probably not.
Look at the laminar boundary layer equations, because that's essentially what we're talking about. It's not, you know, they have wall-normal diffusion. The problem is they go bad if there were any kind of inflection in the flow. I mean, it can go bad for other reasons, but...
Well, the question is, what does go bad mean? Do they stop behaving like the full...
No, I mean they blow up, blow up, yeah.
Not with isotropy.
Viscosity doesn't save you. It's you need full two-dimensionality. I don't just mean the three, if I'm thinking laminar boundary layer. It's not just incompressibility. I mean, you need pressure gradients and vertical acceleration, wall normal accelerations.
Yeah.
So, but that, you know, I'll defer to Idris.
And or horizontally.
Okay. So I think in the interest of time, the only thing I'm going to say is that by keeping the slow x, right, not just suppressing it, which is one thing we've done. I mean, really the question is, what do we do with this system? Okay, we have it. It's lovely. How do you integrate this? It's got two different x's and t. You know, what do you do? Right. So one thing we do is undo some of the good we've done, meaning we, or tried to do, right? We turn off two x's, so we suppress this, just say d by d capital x is zero. We then reinterpret the over bar just as an x average. This is now starting to sound a lot like QL. And then to get rid of two times, we just, these guys are linked via, you know, some chain rule. So we literally just undo all of that. And now you've got this system that you could just co-evolve. And this is basically QL. But you don't want to do this. You absolutely don't want to do this if you're interested in efficiency and if fruit is genuinely small, because now this is a very stiff system. You've undone a lot of the good. We got rid of the slow x. Okay, and that's where Guillaume is going to take over. But
why can't you keep slow time in your slow equations?
I guess the question is, how do you, so that's a good segue, how do you integrate? So if I replace,
I would just apply a time filter to the blue term.
How long do you integrate this system?
Well, that one, you're going to have to integrate forever anyway, yeah. But you haven't created your problem by the simplifications you just made here. It was inherent in the previous, mm-hmm. more general formulations.
I think there's an issue here that is unique to this setup, and that's again where Guillaume will take over. But the idea is this system, if you take temporal scale separation seriously, if you take it seriously, which I'm arguing we should, since that's what we predicated everything on, the U bar and the B bar are locally fixed, right, in time when you integrate this equation. And that will present challenges. So I'm going to switch now because I want Guillaume to have time to. Oops, wrong one. I just pulled up my own again. Okay, Guillaume, I need to give you. Okay.
And it's just space bar arrows.
Okay.
About posing this after.
So, yeah, I'm just going to show you three models. QL models in which you have time scale separation and in which you can evolve them only on the slow time scale and get rid of the fast time scale. So the first one is a very simple, it's the simplest one, is just a coupled set of ODEs. You have two variables, U and F. You can think of U as a slow forcing and F as fast fluctuations. And to enforce this scale separation, you just add a parameter epsilon that we will eventually take small. So if epsilon is small, then you can just think of epsilon here as the inertia, and you have a fast time scale for F. So you have a U which is forced, damped, and there is a feedback from the fluctuation, and the fluctuation have an instantaneous growth rate of given by U over epsilon. So if you just take epsilon is 1, you integrate this numerically, you have this picture, and so you have no scale separation, and both U and F evolve on the same time scale. If you take the same numerics, but you put epsilon 0.1, the surprising feature is that after some transient initial transient, both U and F still evolve on the slow time scale. And it makes this system really easy to integrate, I mean, and to do multiple scale with, because you can just find the solution of this system, and you find the solution of this system by saying that, okay, if F evolves on the slow time scale, then this guy has to be zero at leading order, or small at least. And so if U is zero, then the balance in this equation is between F squared and the forcing. And if I just plot this in this graph, this is exactly what I have. So the point is that for this system, if you just put epsilon to be very, very small, you don't have to integrate this to get to the dynamics of this system. You just have to solve it on the slow time scale by putting U to zero. Okay, now a more interesting system in which so another QL system, or system that will be QL, it's this set of PDEs. So think as theta as a slow field, which is forced, damped, and coupled with fluctuations. And the second equation is the PDE for the fluctuations. Again, they will be fast. They will be coupled with the slow field, and you will have diffusion, and you may have nonlinearities. So this is just Ginsburg-Landau, and this is what drives the growth rates in this equation. Same game, I just put some slowly evolving forcing, and I solve this numerically. And here you have both theta and eta. And this is space time diagram. You have time going this way, space this way. And what you find is that, again, the same dynamics, that after some initial transients, all of these fields evolve on the slow time scale. You don't have bursts. You don't have any fast dynamics. So again, there is hope that as epsilon is very small, you can just solve this on the slow time scale. And this is what I'm going to present. Just to emphasize this point, if you just, for this picture, I'm instead of plotting a 2D diagram, I will plot a 1D diagram. So I just integrate eta over x, eta squared. And you have this picture. So for epsilon, which is of order one, you have some slow dynamics. For epsilon, which is very small, you have bursts, then again slow dynamics. This is very similar to the ODE problem I just mentioned in the introduction. So how do you deal with this? I'm just going to point out the key steps in which you can, how you can do multiple scales in this system. So if I want to treat this with multiple scale, the first idea is to introduce two time scales. So instead of just t, I will have two time scales that will be a slow time and a fast time. The slow time will be the same as t, and the fast time will be very fast, and of order epsilon, 1 over epsilon. So this is how you can define this. This is in the spirit of WKB. This will be fast, but the fastness of this may evolve on time. So what you do then, you can just rewrite this system with these variables. So you have this. And so no assumption to get this. This is where we are going to do multiple scale separation. So this, we have scale separation. Now we just have to expand all of our variables with respect to epsilon. That will be small. So we have to expand both the growth rates, sigma. This field and this field. and then you just solve this system order by order. So let's get. Let's do this. Okay, so now I just solve this order by order with this expansion. So it's actually quite easy. If I just consider this equation at leading order, it will be this term. That will be of order 1 over epsilon. And so I get this. So the first equation tells me that indeed theta is a field that is going to evolve slowly in time. Then I consider this equation at the next order. And I can get rid of this term and obtain an equation only for the leading order variable theta naught and eta naught by doing an average over phi. So if I do this, if I integrate over phi, this gets away. These three terms do not depend on phi, so nothing happens. And now I've got an average over phi. So only thing that remains to be done is to consider this equation at leading order. At leading order, this will be this one. Okay. And now we have exactly a QL system. So we have an equation for the slow evolution of theta, and we have an equation for the fluctuations. This is closed. And in principle, we can just evolve this. Okay. So I won't detail everything, but the key point of this analysis is just to say that this is an eigenvalue problem. You can just this, and this does not depend on phi. So the solution of this equation is of this form. So you get a slow an amplitude that it depends on time. This will be the eigenvector that you can choose normalized, and they depend, and you have an exponential dependence on phi. And you see this problem. You see the problem of QL system in which you have variables that can evolve exponentially fast in time, and it's that this will go exponentially fast, so that what do I do with this? If I really have scaly separation and if these variables evolve exponentially, this is infinite. So the idea is to say, okay, if this system makes sense, then there is only one possibility for this to remain finite. And this is either we have no fluctuations, so A is zero, or this is a constant, so that the growth rate is zero. And this is actually what controls the dynamics of the later system, so that you have fluctuations that evolve along marginal stability. You always have this, which is zero. So how can you, in practice, evolve this system numerically? The idea is to find an equation for the growth rates and to tune this amplitude so that the growth rate always stays zero instead of getting positive. So with a multiple scale, you can derive an equation of this form. So this is an equation for the growth rate of the fluctuations. If you have no fluctuations, then it evolves because this field evolves in time because of forcing and damping. It's this term. And if you have fluctuations, then this field is damped by this term. And it is what this beta stands for. So one possibility to solve this system on the slow time scale is only to time step this equation, the first one. And at every time step, you solve this eigenvalue problem. And you say, OK, if the growth rate is negative, then I have to use this bit. So no fluctuations. If the growth rate is zero, then I have to set to prevent this growth rate from getting positive. And so I get this equals 0, meaning a of t is square root of alpha over beta. So you don't have to time step the fluctuations. You don't care about this. You just do this on the slow time scale. Let me just show you the results, what you get for this problem. So this is what we obtained. If I use this algorithm and this problem, this is what I have. So in dashed line, you have the growth rates of the fluctuation. Once it reaches zero, then the fluctuations are tuned so that it stays to zero. And this is the amplitude of the fluctuations. And definitely, as you make epsilon small in the DNS, you will collapse to this curve. OK. So I will shortly discuss how you can apply this to the problem which has been discussed by Greg. So this is the coupled system discussed by Greg. You have some slow field U and B, U bar and B bar. Forced, this is diffusion. And you have interaction with the fluctuations, this guy and this guy, divergence of the Reynolds stress. And you have equation for the fluctuations on another time scale. So this is a fast time scale. This is a slow time scale. And so this is a stream function. If you are used to it, you recognize advection. You have this term will drive the fluctuation and would lead to instabilities. Coupling with buoyancy and diffusion. And the same here, advection, coupling with a slow field and diffusion. So yeah, if I want to solve this on this time scale, I apply the same algorithm. So I take this set of equations. I just look for exponentially growing fluctuations. So I just have sigma in there. I look for an equation for sigma of this form. It will always be of this form. Alpha and beta are quite involved here, but you can get explicit expression for them. And then you just choose pick the amplitude of the fluctuations A to be such that if the growth rate is negative, then you have no fluctuations. And otherwise, they just prevent the growth rates from getting positive. So the system is always marginally stable. Just a few plots for this example. This is the initial condition. You have some initial strong stratification. You have no velocity field. And you have a forcing that will drive a celerity field of order unity. this serrality field of serrality field of order unity will be such that the fluctuations are linearly unstable. So before you reach this state, you have some instabilities and you have fluctuations that appear. And the end state for this system is that one. So you have critical layers here and here associated with a strong mixing. So this is a total buoyancy, almost constant close to the critical layer. And in between, you have even stronger stratification. Last comment on this system is that you have another degree of freedom, which is this guy K, that you have to pick. Contrary to the previous example, we have this as additional degree, and we pick this K so that at the end, the system we have is linearly stable with respect to every other wave number. So just some concluding remarks. You can apply this to many different situations. One situation that remains to be studied is in which you have several different fluctuations. You may think of this system as evolved. Well, if it evolves and if this peak reaches zero, then you have to consider two different fluctuations. But it can be done in principle, and it can be well efficiently parallelized in the numerics. Greg mentioned the slow X evolution, so it can, in principle, also be done with the same algorithm. And since this procedure holds for any QL system in which you have scale separation, in principle, you can also use it to solve QL CE2, which have been presented a few days ago. And so you can just time step it, in principle, much faster than what has been. Okay, thank you very much.